This week's episode of This Is Only a Test is made possible by you, our dedicated listeners. It's your listening and subscription to this podcast that allows us to not only get together and share with you our thoughts every week, but also make a bunch of our other videos. And I want to give a special shout out to those of you who are members of the Tested Premium community. If you aren't a member yet, head over to tested.com/membership and learn about this year's free gift, a poster drawing by Adam of his last spacesuit, as well as our other great content. Thanks so much for listening. On with the show.
Hey, let's start the show.
For Thursday, March 7th, 2019, welcome to This Is Only a Test, the official podcast of tested.com.
When you said you wanted to give a special shout out, I thought you were going to give a special shout out to like one guy.
No.
You know, like Jason Wachowski. We really appreciate your back and tested, especially.
Hey, I can do it. I can find out who our members are and thank you all if you would like that. But that would be quite many number of you I need to be thanking. But we have begun the podcast and you heard him. It's Jeremy Williams back after a week away. We did a dual cast last week.
Yeah.
And so Jeremy's back. Happy belated birthday, Jeremy.
Thanks, Norm. Appreciate that.
Yeah, happy birthday.
And joining us, Kishore's not in this week, so we have Zach Raddick. Zach, so glad you could make it.
I'm glad I could make it as well.
This is
not that you guys can't handle the dual cast. Like, I know, listened. It was good.
We had talked about it because 2 weeks ago, it was just Kishore and Jeremy.
Yeah.
And then last week, it was me and Kishore. And then we thought rounding things out and doing one with just Jeremy and me. But we thought, let's take this podcast an extra nerdy level and bring in
an Uber nerd.
I mean, before we started recording, we were futzing with our headphones, and there was a hum. There is still a hum. And Zach was able to identify the frequency of that hum.
That's what all hums are these days, is 60 hertz, right? Yeah. Like, everybody knows that. I'm not that nerdy. Yeah.
It was pretty amazing. How are both of you doing? How was your week off, Jeremy? What'd you do?
I had a birthday, and I had a great birthday because I spent the evening taking my eldest, my 12-year-old boy, to see Hamilton.
Whoa, in San Francisco.
That's right, and I got the shirt.
The Hamiltour.
To prove it.
And nice.
It's their first time back in the city. Have you seen the show?
I have not. I'm like the only person that hasn't.
Well, you're the only person in this room that hasn't.
Oh, yeah.
Norm and I both saw it when it was first here 2 years ago. Totally new cast now. This is the cast that actually played with Lin-Manuel in Puerto Rico.
Nice.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And then they left, and now they're starting the tour. They'll be here for 6 months.
Wow. How was this performance compared to the last one? So you've seen two rotating casts.
It was great. I mean, it was great. Some people put their own twist on things in a way that I thought was interesting. The guy who plays Hamilton, he plays it a little different than the last guy that I saw. And how I imagine Lin-Manuel was playing it, he starts out a little more unsure of himself in a way. And then he grows confidence over the course of the play, which is what you... Actually, it makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense for the character. But all the performances were great. And it was just great taking my son to see it.
Yeah.
Because he knew every word, you know. He's been listening to the soundtrack for a year now. Mm-hmm. And just like reciting it. And it's amazing how much he's learned. And for him to actually go and see the performance was exciting for both of us.
Well, someone of his age, does he associate the lyrics and the songs with the original cast? A lot of people, because they know it's a unique musical, like you associate it, whether it's Lin-Manuel or...
I was worried about that.
Yeah, Davy Diggs, they own the roles. They created the roles. And I think the first time I saw it, there are archetypes for the characters they cast to fit into those roles. But I think it's a lot that you don't see in just listening to the soundtrack. You don't see visually that still makes the show worth seeing.
It's like seeing a movie and then reading the book. Like you hear the voices of the person in the movie in the book. Like it's you associate the two.
At the intermission, I was wondering, like, that's when I'd first get to talk to him, and I was worried, like, does he want to go home? Does he not like it? It's not the same as the soundtrack that he knows. But no, he turned to me and said, "This is amazing. This is great."
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, so it was good. It was definitely good. It was, all around, good show, good show.
Very good, very good. Do you have anything other fun things? You were kind of like booked the whole week. I think I did see you on Thursday. You'd come by to behold the baby.
I went to my first red egg and ginger celebration.
Yes.
Which is, are you familiar with the red egg and ginger?
No, tell me about this.
It is a celebration in the Chinese tradition where after the baby it turns 100 days, you get together with friends and family and you celebrate the life of the baby. The baby formally introduced to the community. And so we got to meet Norm's baby. And that was the first time that I had met him. I was, sadly, I realized I'd never made it up because I was sick. Mm-hmm. And I never made it over to your house.
Yep.
And then I finally got to see him.
It was a whole thing.
Yeah.
And there were like 100 people there.
It was a whole thing.
It was a whole thing. It was a...
There was more food than you could possibly imagine.
That
many,
sounds right.
Many courses.
As it should be.
Banquets. A full-blown banquet. Have you had a meal like that before?
No.
That kind of banquet meal?
But I was sitting next to our friend Steve Lin, who was prepping me for everything that was about to happen.
Yeah. Mm. Got to eat that abalone.
Yeah.
The delicious delicacy of abalone. And the baby, of course, performed. Everyone got to see his wide range of emotions and his lungs.
Entrances and exits.
Oh, my goodness. There was one point where we were trying to get him settled, and I had to make my way through the tables, and I was trying to see how many tables I could get in before him erupting. I didn't get past a single table. I'm like, it was
welcome
like a video
to fatherhood.
Game, right? I needed to reset the backup.
At one point, one of Norm's friends brought their baby, and Norm said, "Can I just borrow your baby?"
Nobody will know the difference.
Jeremy's never met him before.
Yeah.
Yeah. Zach, how are things going with you?
Good, good. Busy as always. Got some fun projects going. And
secret projects.
Some secret, some not so secret. But
what are the technologies you're working with?
Ooh, let's see. Mostly these days, big batteries. That's a big fun one. Some big motor controllers. Also working on a tool for my shop, putting together a plasma cutter.
Nice. Is this a different CNC plasma cutter?
CNC plasma cutter. So similar to like the router that we use to do Star Lords, and I do all sorts of stuff.
Big gantry system.
Big gantry, but this, instead of using a spinning tool, this uses plasma. So it's an arc and air and melts
metal.
A pool
of water underneath.
Yep, exactly, to catch all the slag.
Now, last time I heard learned what plasma was, I was in high school.
Yeah.
And they told me that it was a fourth state of matter.
Yeah.
Is that the case still?
I mean, sure. I don't think I've changed physics at all, but...
What can it cut that a laser cannot?
Well, so you can get lasers that can cut through steel. They're mini... hundreds, if not thousands of watts that it takes to do that. But this is a sort of a lower cost, lower barrier to entry way of cutting steel that isn't quite as clean and slick as a laser cutter would be cutting steel. Hmm. But it gives you, 90 or 80% of the sort of abilities of being able to cut, cut material, cut it pretty fast with, minimal cleanup at the end. I mean, it's sort of like it's not as slick as your, laser cutter that you're used to as far as you just, cut it out and go.
Yeah.
This has some drop and some stuff to kind of like grind off, but it's still really, really good.
Right. How
it punches a hole, right? It punches a hole and then the arc kind of drags along.
Exactly, yeah.
That hole to shear the metal.
Yeah, exactly. Hmm. And basically, the technology is just, heat it up with electricity and then blow air at it so that it just kind of pushes through the other side. Like, it's kind of an archaic technology for doing what it does.
You heat up the whole metal sheet?
No. Just at a very, very small spot with an arc. So it's very focused, but it's been around for a long time, though, sort of modern power electronics and technology has really made it accessible and inexpensive for, to get going. It's pretty slick.
How thick can you cut?
It's more based on how much time you want to spend. Like the power unit that I have is rated, I think, for like half an inch.
Holy
cow.
Of steel.
Of steel. Yeah, so any ferrous material, or conductive, actually it doesn't have to be ferrous, it can be conductive. So, copper, aluminum, steel, anything that conducts electricity, it can cut.
So are all plasma cutters essentially the same power? Like laser cutters are rated with wattage. Is this voltage? Is this...
There's different powers as well. So mine is a 45 amp, just similar to like a laser would be wattage, but it's basically the same kind of rating.
That's a lot of power draw.
It is. I mean, it takes a lot of power to do that, but it is really focused, just like a laser. I mean, in a way that it's just concentrating that energy, it's melting that material. So it's one more tool in my toolbox.
That is cool. The CNC router parts, CNC machine we had built over at Frank's shop 2 years ago now, was both CNC and plasma cutter in one gantry. You
pretty
swap
slick.
Out
yeah.
The access.
I thought about doing that because a lot of the parts are the same,
yeah.
but I'm just thinking sawdust and fire is kind of a bad combo. So I'm keeping them in separate rooms.
Wow. Good for you.
You got the space.
I have some space.
Awesome. Awesome. And I'm sure as we're going to talk to the podcast, we'll hear more about other things you're working with.
Sure.
Hey, also, it is our 490th episode.
490th.
Yes. We are 10 episodes away.
Moments away.
Countdown to 500. Okay. I think at this pace,
we will be
exactly in May, we'll have our 500th episode.
Okay.
I feel like every episode should be a special occasion.
I think you need a banquet now.
That's episode, when we get to episode 500, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe a 500 course banquet.
Can we get Will and Gary back in here?
I'm going to try.
Yeah.
I'm going to book them now for May.
Do it.
But I feel like, if we're counting down to 10, we should do something special every episode.
Oh.
Nothing this episode because we haven't planned for it yet.
Yeah.
No. But maybe best moments. I don't know. The history. But that's a lot of hours of podcasting, of talking in front of a mic. Yeah.
I have a list of things in my phone. I have a notes file called Things That Annoy Me.
Oh?
And I could reveal one every week.
Wait, just in life?
Yeah.
Why do you have that? It's like a therapeutic thing?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. I actually thought it might make an interesting podcast segment once I amassed enough of them.
How many are there?
I'll come up with some more.
I think as long as you have an audio intro, it could totally work.
That's what it needs.
Yeah, that's all it needs.
All right. For you out there, for those of you who generate, who make the awesome theme music for our segments,
Justin, aka Speed.
Yes, we need a new theme music.
Yeah.
Things That Annoy Me. Can you say things that annoy me?
Here's a soundbite. Things That Annoy Me.
Love it. So good.
I'm going to pull that out at its own separate track and put that online. Wow. Is the idea that you want to, over time, these things will no longer annoy you because you've grown as a person?
Sometimes I just think talking about them helps, you know, just getting it out. And maybe, because they're things that I think you could help me understand, because I don't understand why they happen.
Mm. And people, can we get a preview?
No, I don't really waste one. I don't have enough. I've maybe just enough to get to May.
All right, so you're fewer than 10. Okay,
no,
so
maybe this time.
Your task, Jeremy, is then to rank them into things that annoy you the least to the most, and we'll go.
Okay, by the end of this podcast, we need at least one for the end. The last segment will be just give us a hint.
All right, we'll see. Right. Should we move on?
This is gonna be too personal. All right, let's go.
Story this week.
We're actually recording this episode early this week on a Monday, even though most of you will be listening to this Thursday or later. But that doesn't mean there's any shortage of news breaking or news, although there could be just a lot more stuff that happens in the next 3 days. We had the biggest thing that happened, the thing we've been waiting for, a lot of people have been waiting for, the $35,000 Tesla Model 3 has been announced.
Mm-hmm. This is the promised price of the car to begin with.
I was gonna say, it was announced years ago.
Yes.
But
I guess the availability
is
now announced.
Which was a surprise, right? I didn't see this coming.
You think it would be later? People have been waiting for this for so long.
I just didn't expect it now.
I just thought it was vapor. Like, I didn't actually, that's...
And I think that's a lot of people were suspecting that, right? Obviously, last year was a big year for the launch of this Model 3. You know, it's kind of shot up to the charts on EVs, changed the landscape, really, of our roads, especially in places, big cities. We see
Absolutely.
Them everywhere now in the Bay Area. And they had announced a intermediate model, a standard range model, to get between that 310 and 220. I think it was a 260 mile range model. And so there's some speculation that the $35,000 car would be very limited quantities. That it would just be maybe available just almost on paper.
Just to prove that they did
just
it.
Just to prove they did it, but you'd be put on a long waiting list or that it just wouldn't be really reasonable. Because with their higher-end cars, you're kind of forced to choose the premium package, like all the accessories and all the
There add-ons. Was no choice.
Yeah, right. If you wanted to get it. So I guess the early adopter period is over. And this could signal a couple of things for Tesla. It could signal that they're manufacturing, they're more confident in it. And we talked about last week how Consumer Reports had already docked them a little bit on customer satisfaction and just consistency in the manufacturing, at least in those early cars. They think that Tesla thinks that that's all been smoothed out.
The reliability.
Yes. And so now this is a car. And also, of course, last year Tesla hit their milestone for how many cars that they had sold across their entire EV line to fit under the federal tax rebates.
Right.
And so the tax rebate is halved now, I believe, and will be going away over time. So even though this is a $35,000 car, a lot of people were hoping for $35,000 minus $7,500,
yeah,
$10,000 in California. Right now, it's more likely $3,500. California's their fund for EVs is dwindling as well, and there's like a backlog, of course, of people getting their rebates. Same with PG&E. So this really is not that $25,000 car people are hoping for, but that I think would have been a pipe dream anyway.
Right.
I don't think the investors were looking to that as.
Well, it was a good story. Like, it was, and it drove pre-orders up. I mean, well,
yeah.
I know a few people in this room that
totally
may have put some money down. Yeah,
I pre-ordered one. I got my money back. You, however, stuck with it.
Yep.
And you got one of the earlier editions.
I did, and totally happy with it.
Yeah.
The thing that I think it's worth mentioning. So 220 miles. Which sounds like a lot, and it is a lot if you're talking about compared to other electric vehicles. Ooh,
what?
A bit of a sound. No, that's you, Jeremy.
I'm do not disturb.
And as you guys know, owning electric vehicles, and even anyone who owns a cell phone or a big battery knows, like, or anything with a big battery, you're not going to really have it at capacity all the time.
Right.
And in fact, for EVs, they don't recommend you filling up to capacity.
20 to 80% all the time.
Exactly. 20 to 80%. So what's your usable range? 220 miles? That means you're really losing 40 miles on the high end, on the top end, and 40 miles on the bottom, 50 miles conservatively. You're talking about really 120 to 150 mile range,
yeah,
car if you're going on trips.
Right.
Which is more than enough for day trip and for most people a commute comfortably.
For most people. But I know from experience, you know, if I'm visiting clients on the peninsula and I've got a couple stops, like I can easily put in over 100 miles in a day. Like that's not that hard to do. And I think you start getting range anxiety when you're, you know, even if you're at, you know, below 50%, you know, it's like you kind of go, oh, well, I better figure out, you know, how much longer I've got. So, you know, it's, I think, you know, when you start pushing 300, then that anxiety kind of goes away. But if you're in the low twos, that's
yeah,
not that much usable.
Yep.
Do you think anyone will actually buy the $35,000 model?
Tons of people will buy it. But they should know the caveats. Not only the range, I think, is the number one thing.
Yeah.
Right? Like the 220, it sounds like a good number. I think it's more reasonably 150. And I think the type of person who's going to buy the $35,000 Tesla is probably more accustomed to like a $15,000 or $20,000 gas car in which you're going to get 300 miles of range and you're not going to be used to charging overnight or using or adding an hour in your commute to go to a supercharger.
You know, when you go to buy a website, you know, and you have the three different tiers, you got the cheap one, you've got the crazy expensive enterprise one, and you got the big one in the middle that says Best Buy.
Yep.
Right. I think that is what the standard range plus is.
Sorry, 240 mile range.
Yeah.
One. So yeah,
it's only $2,000 more. You get 20 more miles of range. You get a faster top speed, and you get a better interior.
The better interior. That's the thing. This is why I also feel
these
like
are the caveats.
The $2,000 gets you not only the range, but also like your adjustable seats. Everything is manual. The seats are just crappier quality. But people are price sensitive.
Yeah, but I think when they see what you get for that amount more, it does not. It's percentage wise, it's not that much of a difference.
Well, if somebody's financing it, it's only I don't know what it amortizes out to, but it's not going to be that much more per month. So I'm going to guess they're going to sell that middle tier a lot more, just from, you know,
yeah,
because it's going to be $10 more a month or something like that.
The interesting thing is that from what we had known from what the middle tier was released, these weren't the same batteries.
Right.
It actually weighed less.
Right.
There were fewer cells in them. So I wonder what the difference is in terms of the 35,000, the 220-mile car and the 240 miles. Is that a software?
Are you going to be able to pay extra in the future? And then
can you get upsold?
Well, yeah, they did that before with the 70 and 75 kilowatt-hour battery,
mm-hmm,
where they actually unlocked the advantages for a fee. Right. You basically had all of the hardware.
And that seems to be a model that Tesla is embracing in terms of letting you add on features or even demo features. Because they've done trial periods where you can get autopilot for trial and then purchase on the spot if you like it.
The BOM cost difference is not that much, but they can then upsell you later. So right. It costs more to have two different assembly lines.
What do you think? How does that make you feel? I mean, I get that that makes sense from a business perspective, but from a owner's perspective, if I have all of the hardware in the car, I swear to God, dude, I don't know. How about I shut down all my other tabs? Does that make you happy?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's that much different than iPhone with more memory. Like the actual cost of the memory is not $400, but I pay $400 for, you know, the extra memory in my iPhone.
Yeah, but that's a difference between the memory actually already being there and the software.
Yeah,
locked
but I don't. But the actual cost, I mean, I just look at it for what I'm paying for. It does not cost $400 for me to have that much more RAM in my iPhone. But you know, so I don't feel cheated about it. But that's just because of I sort of know how the economics work. So
does it end? Like, could they do a 200-mile car and charge even lower for that, and then do more software unlocks?
Well, I'm just waiting for somebody to come up with their own, you know, hack around it, and then you know.
that would be the reason, because that would happen inevitably.
Sure.
Or maybe it's breaking warranties, or maybe I don't know how exactly batteries work, but is it like CPUs where they bin them, and in the manufacturing process they know?
I think it would be too hard. Dude. I think it'd be too hard to give somebody poor batteries. I think across the line they're building the same car. Again, you get the economies of scale, and you know, and then it's just a software flag.
Yeah, right. And I, for whatever reason, like, I'm not as hurt by that when it is purely software. If it's a game that has DLC or something that I unlock by paying a dollar and suddenly I can get that bit flipped in my code,
yeah,
that makes sense to me. But when there's actual hardware that I have that is like weight, that takes atoms.
that you're carrying around with you.
Yes, that I actually have purchased in some sense of the word. I feel like I should be able to use them. It's a weird thing. So in the sense of me...
Even though you paid less.
Yes. So it's like the sense that I'm okay with it from a software's perspective tells me that this is forward thinking, that this is going to be the wave of the future, that people are going to be buying hardware that they can't use until they unlock it with some sort of, you know... IAP.
Yeah.
But it still hurts.
So speaking of features that you're unlocking, a bunch of Tesla announcements we're going to have in our top story this week. A bunch of other Tesla announcements came out, specifically with their self-driving. So this is also the year that Tesla anticipates that the full self-driving capability will be unlocked on the cars that have the hardware. And it's been something that a lot of people have speculated whether it can happen. And the way they've worded it is really interesting. They say that it will offer automatic driving on city streets, which makes sense as full self-driving. This is all still computer vision, optical vision based. Excuse me. But a lot of people don't know if it's going to... It's not been proven. That's my point. What do you guys think?
I think there's enough other companies that are using... sort of a lot more hardware tech that haven't got to that point yet. So I feel like Tesla's starting at a disadvantage going with, you know, I mean, they do have, I'm pretty sure they have radar as well. So it's not purely optical.
There's radar, the little circles in front of the back of the cars, the bumpers.
Or ultrasonic or whatever.
Yeah, ultrasonic, that's what it is.
But, you know, they don't have LiDAR. They don't have a lot of more active sensing. And I know some of these other companies that are, experimenting with a lot more technology, they don't have fully autonomous, you know, level 5. So I kind of go, you know, if this was only that far away, I would expect more kind of demos. I would expect more kind of other companies to be close to it as well. Because, you know, at the end of the day, the technology, even though, yes, it's kind of walled off in different companies, you know, a lot of it is shared. A lot of the, you know, the barriers to doing this are, you know, just sort of general technologies that kind of get developed and you know, general AI practices and other sensor technology that if it was only a year away, we would just see a lot more of it already.
I think the technology probably is at a point now where in certain conditions, there's a car at Tesla that can navigate city streets.
Oh, in certain conditions, absolutely.
And Elon has seen this, and he knows that we are that close. But the problem is that with this kind of technology, that last 10%...
It's all edge cases.
...is just infinitely difficult.
This is like Tesla's fake 5G. right? It's a 5G evolution, right? It's not level 5. It's like level 4 plus. And they're wording it carefully.
But even if it was 4 plus, that's still, I think, generous.
Wow. Okay.
I do. Again, because I'm not seeing, you know, if it's only 6 months away or a year away, like, I would think there would be more demos or more beta vehicles or more just other things that you know, would sort of hint at that.
And I think in the wording, so because they did reword the wording on exactly what their EAP, Enhanced Autopilot, and the full autopilot, full self-driving, FSD, can offer. What they said for full self-driving is that it will recognize stop signs and streetlights.
But will it stop at them?
And it will navigate streets, right? So it says nothing.
Doesn't about say legally. Doesn't say
legality.
Without running over people.
Pedestrians, exactly. Yeah. And so what they're basically advertising and what they're being cautious about promising, even though marketing may appear otherwise, is that in a perfect scenario, in a completely controlled environment or zero other variability, other factors, it could do those things. And I believe that based on the optical technology and the ultrasonics. But whether in practice...
Can you go to sleep behind the wheel?
I mean, and they would never advertise that.
You can't even do that on the highway yet.
Right. Like, all of their self-driving capabilities are all assisted capabilities.
Right. And they're relying on the liability of the driver to say, is there somebody in front of me? Run them over, yes, no.
Exactly.
What is the newer version of highway that you have where it can transition highways?
Navigate on autopilot.
So even when it transitions from lanes,
it requires a confirmation by a quick tap on the stock.
That's not full autopilot.
No,
it seems so far.
It's not
away.
Level 5.
Yeah,
it just seems miles away.
And also the question is, I mean, I think definitely for urban areas, big cities, you're not going to want to use FSD really because there are just people running around jaywalking. But small town suburbia, you know, bigger, wider streets, lots of miles with lots of stoplights. Is that going to matter? Are people going to...
Well, maybe it's an education of the general populace of like, oh, well, now I can't jump out in front of cars and expect them to stop. I mean, part of it is like this expectation that, oh, it, you know, somebody's just going to stop if I jump out or just kind of that level of... It's sort of like at train tracks. Like if you knew that a train was coming, you know, because trains don't stop, you're not going to go on those tracks.
But the cars don't signal. The cars don't let you know that, like, even on the freeway, you don't know when another car is on autopilot. And researchers, we talked about this, researchers have said that cars need to flag some way, you know, that eye contact with the pedestrian crossing the street. They need to, there is a visual signal that needs to happen.
I think it's a general education for the populace to be like, okay, there are things making decisions that aren't humans, and we have to be more cautious around them, both other drivers and other pedestrians. And I think it's both. You know, I think that there's technology, but it's not going to be perfect, and you're just going to have to engineer, you know, the mainstream.
I think in terms of kids jumping in front of automobiles, you're probably better off jumping in front of a Tesla that's on autopilot.
Oh, right now, yes.
And in fact, that's what concerns me, as you know, in addition to many other things, is like, what kind of false positives are the drivers going to see when they're on full auto? Are they going to, because my car beeps all the time when it thinks I'm going to hit somebody.
Right.
And it's, you know, I'm in control, so.
You can ignore those beeps.
I ignore the beep, but the car might not be that sure of itself.
So are you going to be slamming on the brakes all the time?
Exactly.
Yeah. No, it's going to be interesting.
Yeah. Also in Tesla news, I mean, for people who have not bought the upgrades, it's a little bit slap in the face because the feature set has changed. They also paid a little more. You pay for the promise, right? And we've been advocates of never paying for the promise of these features unlocked. Now, the prices went up. The idea is that you would pre-order these features, pay for the promise, and you would have a lower price. And now the real price is actually even lower.
Right. It's like paying for a Kickstarter, and instead of getting that cheap deal, you paid a lot more.
You paid a lot more. The feature went on discount immediately, even before it's coming out. So a little bummed out for those people who paid for the full self-driving capabilities. Well, still don't have it yet.
People who pay for their cars already.
Exactly. That's who have their cars.
Yeah.
And that 100% is a software-gated feature.
But you haven't discussed why the prices of the cars have gone down, have you?
Why have they gone down?
Because they're getting rid of their retail presence.
Right.
Is that their direct correlation?
Well, they say they have to do that in order to sell them for this price.
And so they're moving to an online-only sales model, which is becoming more the norm for cars.
Well, sure, except for it makes it a lot harder to test drive them. What they're saying now is you can now test drive a Tesla by buying one.
Oh my God.
And returning it anytime within a week or 1,000 miles, whichever comes first.
That's not a very good customer experience.
Well, I mean, it's
a proven customer experience in other, you know, other markets, not cars.
But it's not for test drives. It's like basically buying. The promise of a good return policy is more beneficial to the seller than the buyer.
It's just an expensive test drive. Like, that is a big commitment. And it's just interesting because people will abuse this. And Tesla practically invites it in their language when they say you can literally buy a Tesla, drive it for a week, bring it back, and we'll give you money
back. I'm sure they limit it to how many times you could do that. You do it the one time on your driver's license, that's it.
Okay.
You got your 999-mile road trip
All
right,
paid for.
Tesla Cannonball Run, Jeremy, next week, we're doing it.
Where can you go?
Where can you go?
The question is, do you have to return it to the same place?
Right,
oh, that's a one-way.
Point to point. Right. That's a good rental. That's good.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I didn't say that out loud.
Also, with a $35,000, there's only one color that comes in $35,000. It's the black. Every other color is an upsell, like a four-figure upsell. The red is an additional $2,500.
Of course, yeah. That was a change that happened late last year, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. So they've been doing like kind of evolving pricing schemes, right, to kind of maximize their sales. One perspective is that this is just how business works, and, you know, prices on things change all the time.
Well, it's how consumer electronics works.
It's different
than cars.
Yeah, and they're treating this like the way you buy it, to the way you use it to as a piece of technology rather than a annual everything locked down. Car feature sets change, price changes, and people have not complained. The other argument is that they're doing this because they're desperate, because they need to move the cars off the lot. They had this huge influx in sales. They're getting these cars shipped overseas to Europe now, but in order to maintain that growth, they need to tweak the pricing.
Yeah.
Well, we'll find out.
We'll find out. And the other thing we'll find out, the last bit of Tesla news, is March 14th.
New car.
The unveil of
the Y.
The SUV light, the crossover.
From sex to sexy.
So the only other detail, that's right, S3 Y's.
S3XY.
XY, that's right. Mm-hmm. There's one teaser image, but the only other details is that it's going to use the same battery, the same base platform as the Model 3, but because it's a larger form factor, range is going to be cut by, 10%? And the price is going to be 10% more.
Yeah, they're saying it'd be 10% bigger. So it costs 10% more.
With 10% reduction in range.
Yeah.
But you get the hauling capability. The carrying capacity.
The Model 3 is not tiny. I mean,
no.
Like, it looked tinier than it was going to be. It's actually much closer to the Model S in terms of length than I expected it to be.
Yeah. It's comfortable in the back.
So I'll be curious to see, like, wow, like, what do they make an SUV look like
right
that? I mean, it's already spacious.
Yeah,
it's going to be, I would imagine, pretty nice in there.
And the research is there, right? Like the X, I think they know is an anomaly. Like, they over engineered that.
They won't do the Falcon Wing doors.
They won't do the Falcon Wing doors again. That was a showy piece of technology as a car. They know in the automobile business, like, it's trucks that sell.
Right, and it's utility.
And it's the small, mid-size SUVs, your RAV4s, your CX-5s, and the Mazdas that sell. And so this is directly entering that space because they need parents to buy these.
That's it.
To carry their kids around.
And you know, the S and the X dropped in price by about 10,000.
Wow.
So it's all dropped because of the, it all dovetails with the financial incentives going away and retail now going away too.
Do you think there'll be as much excitement for the Y just in the Tesla?
I don't think it has the same buzz. I think for Tesla fans, yes, but I think the idea, I mean, what made the Model 3 so appealing to the masses was, a $35,000 Tesla.
When previously it was $80,000 to $100,000.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I can get it for a fraction of the cost, and it's the same thing. And, you know, all of those things that sort of, they touted it as, you know, all the same features, just, you know, just cheaper.
I'm really curious in that market, like, you know, they've sold a couple hundred thousand of these now. For those people buying, are they one car households, or like, what's the average in that you know, in that economic price bracket, how many cars do those people usually have? And is it like the sedan and the SUV? Like, have they done that research and are counting on people to buy two cars?
Wow. I think it's a weird market, because again, they're treating it more as a consumer electronic than they are an automobile.
And
so
Apple
a lot
does the same
that,
thing. Right. Apple knows that the people who have enough money to buy an iPhone have enough money to buy an iPhone and an Apple Watch,
right,
and maybe a MacBook,
right,
and get you in the family.
These are all premium products. Even at the $35K, it's still a premium because it's not a gas guzzler. Like, it's just, you know.
And there are plenty of people who, when they first bought the S, their next car was the X.
Right.
They were sold.
Yeah.
And it's compelling, the, you know, going all EV, as you guys know.
Yeah.
And I think EV is less of a strange phrase now.
Right.
And
people, though, for the record, I'm hybrid, not 100%.
He's not all EV.
I know. I'm like, okay, only
he's
half,
like for 50,
half as
50
cool as
miles.
You guys.
Got it. I want a Tesla scooter. Give me that Tesla Razor scooter.
They're never going to
like tomorrow.
That.
I will pick that up.
I'll make you a sticker, Jeremy. I'll make you a sticker for your bird.
Wait. You're talking about like a like a skateboard type thing,
yes,
with a handlebar.
Yes.
With a 15-inch screen in the middle.
What would Tesla bring to that?
It would go fast. It would look good. It would just be a fun ride. You know? It would have autopilot.
No. It's just software. Come on, it's just software.
That'd be fun.
I think that a lot of their competitive advantage is their network that they've built up, and also the technology they've put in the in-car experience, the dash and that stuff.
I mean, I think it's branding. I think a lot of it is branding. These days, I mean, it's you own a Tesla. I mean, it's just, at least in this area, yeah. I think there's a lot of status in that. It used to be a BMW or a Porsche or whatever, and now the car of, you know, premium choice is a Tesla.
Yeah, we'll have to see. We'll come back March 14th.
Oh, see, I muted for you guys. Now it won't play music.
All righty. We edge closer and closer to the galaxy's edge.
They're less far away.
What does that mean? Oh, you're talking about Star Wars.
Star Wars.
Yeah.
Hey, episode 9's coming out this year.
I thought you were excited because there's a Marvel movie coming out this weekend.
There is a Marvel movie coming out this
weekend. Yeah, I figured for
Captain
sure
Marvel.
that would be the top story of your pop culture section. But all right,
we talked a little bit about that last week with the reviews. There was the premiere, of course, of Captain Marvel. I have my tickets. I'm watching it this Saturday, I believe. But Star Wars, are people less excited about Star Wars now?
Yes. Yes, thank you, Disney.
Thank you, Jeremy.
What? What did I do?
It's all you, Jeremy. It's your fault.
Saturation that people are less interested in Star Wars?
I think the movies have disappointed.
Solo. Yeah.
So.
I like Rogue One.
Yeah. Well, Galaxy's Edge, it's a reason to get re-excited. The rides are being finalized. People have now seen more details about the new ride, specifically the Millennium Falcon, the Smuggler's Run ride. And these new lands are going to open in Disneyland, Disney World.
Smuggler's Run is the Millennium Falcon ride?
I believe
so. Yeah, it's exciting.
Yeah.
What do you know about it? I know that everybody in the cockpit has a role to play, right?
The interactivity is interesting.
Yeah.
Right? Like, how much interactivity...
It's bridge crew.
I would love bridge crew. That would be fun.
But, I mean, that's kind of how they described it. I mean, there's a pilot, there's a gunner, and there's an engineer. Like...
So the visuals are programmatic.
Yeah.
Is what they're saying.
Yeah, like, real time.
Not just sound effects in the cockpit. Because there was that... Have you guys been to Disney World? Epcot has the mission Earth.
Mm-hmm. Right? I have not been in the past 20 years.
It's the Gary Sinise one with an actual... Gravitron style, like flight simulator, like you're spinning, you get G-forces, and there are four roles in that one as well, but all the buttons do nothing. You sit in the chair, you're told at a certain point.
They're just baby toys.
Yeah, right. Like, go press the landing gear now, pilot, and then you're pressing the button, and then, so is this going to be that, or is it actually?
No, this is real, man. I think this is going to be real. That's what makes this so interesting, is that it's real-time graphics with real-time effects that you have on.
I don't know if I want that. I don't know if I want my experience.
A video
to be,
game? Yes, you do.
But if I'm in a ride with, let's say, eight other people, right? Because they're going to pack people in these cockpits. It's not going to be the four smugglers, right?
No.
You know, the photos may show four people, but it's going to be a lot of seats.
So my concern is the only fun one, the gunner or the engineer or whatever.
No, I just want to go there for the ride.
Are there going to be seats that are just epically more entertaining than the others?
The visuals and the motion simulation should be enough.
You want Star Tours.
Yeah, I'm happy with Star Tours.
No, I see, that's it. Like, I would rather have something new.
But you're not actually controlling the gimbal.
Why not?
No. The safety.
Dude, that would be amazing.
Well, I mean, it's just a fancy VR game, right? But, I mean, so it's an immersive VR experience, just not with goggles. It's with a screen in front of the window.
I think there's confusion. I don't think, and I'm happy to be wrong, but I don't think that the pilot seat is going to be able to actually adjust the yaw of your cockpit. Or
there's
change
gonna be
anything
some,
meaningful.
Not meaningful, but I bet there's something. Maybe. I bet there's either a score keeping or because, you know, some of their other rides, you know, there's the Buzz Lightyear shoot 'em up thing.
Yeah.
Like there is some, like they've been experimenting with sort of gameplay in their rides for a long time. So this to me is just sort of the next step.
Midway Mania.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I bet there's going to be something where you can, you know, get scored or you can be better, or
the more they can do that, the more people will want to replay it. And that's, I mean, if you can re-ride a ride and have a completely different sensation and maybe like get your buddies to go with you so that you can have the best experience
or unlock Easter eggs or, oh, did you see the, you know, hidden Mickey or the whatever it is in that experience, they're going to eat that up.
I have no question that ride's going to be phenomenal. My problem is going to be the lines themselves.
That's the problem.
Like the imagery that they've showed of Galaxy's Edge so far have had 10 guests in them.
You know? So Nerdist made a huge write-up, right? And there are some more clarifying details. They detail, of course, as you go through the Millennium Falcon, how amazing the recreation of the line waiting experience will be.
They've made lines better.
Exactly.
But there's still lines.
There's plenty of opportunity for photos. And they also said that the cockpit, because we've heard that they'll have this kind of carousel cockpit system.
Sure.
Six riders per cockpit,
okay,
which is fewer than I expected. Uh-huh. I would thought at least eight. Six riders per cockpit? How long is this ride going to be? How many people can they cycle through?
How many cockpits are there?
How many cockpits are there, right? Even if you're generously talking about a system which you have a dozen cockpits, right, you're still cycling six people at a time, mm-hmm, you know, a minute each or so, if it's like a, you know, 5-10 minute experience.
Well, I mean, yeah, maybe it is. Is it possible that it is on rails? I mean, is it possible it's like
they can move the cockpits out of the way somehow, some kind of carousel or multiples.
Totally.
And,
I mean, that's exactly what the Harry Potter ride does in Universal, right?
So
they put four people on a tracked system.
That's a huge, you know, it's basically a roller coaster with a robotic arm.
So basically, is this what that is? Is each cockpit like its own robotic arm?
Right.
And it just gimbal system, it moves away for the
and
next
it just
one.
Moves away. It kind of aligns in. Six people walk in. A minute later, another one.
No, it'd be faster than that, I would hope.
Depending on how many there are and how long the experience is.
They could be clever and split people off. And I mean, I you know, if anybody's going to do it,
that's Imagineers. Exactly.
Yeah, that's Imagineers.
That's Disney magic.
So
the question is, for Smuggler's Run, once you're in the cockpit, I have no doubt that the buttons will do something in cockpit. Press a button, it will toggle a light. You know, you can move the joystick and some funky animatronic thing will happen. But whether it actually controls the experience
so
than real-time running of lasers.
Look at how much success they've had partnering with The Void, where you must accomplish tasks in order to proceed through the game, essentially.
No, it's got to be like lockdown limits. I think...
Well, I'm sure there's going to be limits, but it's got to do... I mean... It's going to be so much better if you pull a lever and something shakes, something moves, something physical happens. Like, that would be such a waste if it didn't. I'd be so frustrated.
Yeah, no, it's
going to
happen.
That would be one of my, you know, Jeremy's...
Things that frustrate me.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm frustrated the fact that even with Star Tours, I know that if I go through Star Tours three times, I've seen most of the content.
Yep.
I'm good. I'm not going to use my entire day at Disneyland here. It feels like... To get the full Millennium Falcon experience, you got to go back to Disneyland like a dozen times.
That's what they want.
Oh, that's frustrating. I don't want to wait in that line a dozen times.
You're going to have to.
That's the double-edged sword.
Right?
I'm not looking.
You won't be satisfied with the one run.
No.
See, that's... And
they should just rename it Smuggler's Runs.
Right? Like, oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No one's going to be happy. I mean, you're going to be happy coming out of it, but you're going to be left wanting more.
that's what they're all about.
We have to get in on some kind of early access treatment. That's the only way to experience Galaxy's Edge.
So the other ride is Star Wars Rise of the Resistance. And this may be controversial, but I like this idea of a ride more. I like the dark ride. I like what Disney is known for. Taking you on a seat, going through real buildings, fake buildings, getting some cool effects, seeing some animatronics.
This feels comfortable to you.
Yes. Yes. I think that having one Star Wars themed is going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I can't complain about that, but it doesn't feel like it's pushing the limits.
Sometimes it's just nice to admire the work.
Yeah.
You know, even if the technology is not groundbreaking.
Well, maybe I am happy that someone like you, Jeremy, who is such a big Star Wars fan, is less enthused about Star Wars.
Are we going to have to take away your nerd cards? No, we need to push the limits on everything.
I'm trying to reduce the level of excitement nerdity so that the lines won't be so long.
Oh, right. This sounds like a horrible ride. Nobody should go there.
All right, from Star Wars over to Star Trek. Right after we recorded the podcast last week, we got news that Star Trek Discovery Season 3 has been greenlit. So we're going to get another season. That means it's a real Star Trek show. This is no longer like an experimental.
Yeah.
It's going to get for one season, a blip in the canon of Star Trek. This is going to have a foothold in Star Trek lore.
Next
and
gen
be meaningful.
It didn't even hit its stride until like season
exactly.
three, right?
That's what I'm hoping for. That's exactly it.
Hmm.
Next year, all the characters will be established. Maybe there'll be a uniform change. Who knows? Alex Kurtzman's getting another co-showrunner. So I'm excited. Even though for season two, I'm going to wait till it finishes before I binge it all. I think that's the strategy here. The Picard show, a few news there. They've begun casting, although there are some rumors/leaks about the roles that the supporting cast will play. Those have been unverified, but they have said they have picked the director for the pilot episode, and she has begun the casting process. So
it's exciting. Yeah. I'm excited for that way more than anything else.
Oh yeah,
in Trek world.
Yeah, just stay in good health, everyone working on that.
Yeah,
Patrick Stewart. We had the Oscars last week. Talk a little bit about that. Of course, everyone, you know, Green Book won. But a strong contender was Roma, which was Netflix's first big Oscar contender. Now, one person not quite happy about that, Steven Spielberg.
Why is he unhappy?
He firmly believes, and he's going to take this to the Academy Board.
Oh, my gosh.
That the only movies that should qualify are ones that are made for the cinema, the big screen. Not for the small screen. If you do a movie for TV, it is a TV movie, and that belongs with the Emmys. If you want to, contend for the Academy Awards,
I mean, it is a different experience
for theaters, theatrical release. This also sounds this bitterness out of Spielberg is uncharacteristic. Like, is this really the thing he wants to fight for and die on? Like. Making the case that Netflix, Amazon, and Hulu films and the filmmakers working on that, their movies don't belong in contention along the same, along with the other films?
But it
is it really all about the size of the screen and the number of people you see it with? Or is it about adhering to some other kind of architecture?
So currently there's the line is it needs a exclusive, they need a theatrical window, but it doesn't have to be exclusive.
Yeah.
And I feel like this is him trying to, in his perspective, him saving cinemas.
Right.
Him thinking that films have an unfair advantage when there's part of a subscription service or part of something you can just watch on your phone, and that when people pay to watch a movie in theaters, it is a different experience.
The barrier to entry is higher. You have to go someplace, you have to pay more, you have that whole thing that you have to do. Therefore, it's judged like completely different.
It's a shared experience with your fellow man.
Oh, absolutely. No, I think it is just very different. It's just a different thing. I mean, I still love going to the movies, even though I have a big screen at home and I have all the media and all of those things. It doesn't compare. So to me, I get his argument. Like, it makes sense, but maybe that's just my opinion.
It sounds so petty.
I don't know, man.
I think there's room for both. I think if you're talking about an institution like the Academy Awards, which has been criticized for not moving along with the times, both in terms of the types of films and the filmmakers it celebrates, the organization should be about the celebration of movie making. It's not even about celebration of film because people don't film anymore. It's all digital anyway.
Spielberg films.
Sure. Spielberg, Nolan, they film. Tarantino, they film, right? But at some point, the definition of a movie, you're still talking about an hour and a half to 2 hour single story in that form factor. I mean, the theaters that we're watching movies in today are nothing like the theaters that people were watching movies in 100 years ago.
I don't know. It's still that shared experience. I think it's still a destination. It's still your just the whole experience feels different. So
I mean, he's earned whatever right he has, right? I mean, he grew up going to movies. There's all the lore about sneaking into the studio and, you know, getting...
And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm saying that you can still have those things don't feel mutually exclusive. And if the line he is drawing is that the new type of experience that people have, the new way that more people are watching these movies is something that he feels like comes at a detriment to the theatrical experience. He wants to have that punished by not recognizing them.
The problem is there's no stopping that. Whether or not he puts up a fight.
Right.
If that's the way things are going to go, that's a train.
And if the Academy goes that way, the Academy won't be long for this world.
But the Academy still votes.
The Academy Awards are like, I think, more boring than they ever have been. People are less interested now than they have been in years. So it's not, they should embrace whatever future
Exactly. And I think there's room for both.
Right.
I think you can make the case that the theatrical experience is special and something to be held on to and something to be promoted, at the same time as opening your arms for different types of filmmaking.
Well, that's what I was saying. The fact is the Academy does vote on everyone that wins, they vote on everything.
Yeah.
So, you know, if things that are made for the small screen never win because the Academy has spoken, and that's what, you know, they're better experiences, they're better movies, whatever they are, then it's sort of almost self-selecting in a way, like, well, why limit it artificially to say, you know, no, they're not, you know, they can't be voted on. Let them vote, and, you know, maybe it's just going to be, you know, self-selecting.
It feels very gatekeeping on his part.
Yeah.
And it just seems a little uncharacteristic. Hmm. I'm sure, I hope that he'll change his mind about it. Maybe when his next film, the first time his film gets picked up for the streaming service.
He can do what he wants.
Right. He absolutely can.
Directed half of my favorite films.
Exactly. and then also made Ready Player One. So we got a couple of new movie trailers out this past week. There was a new X-Men Dark Phoenix trailer. This feels like a movie that no one's really kind of holding their breath for.
No.
It is the culmination of the soft reboot of the X-Men franchise that with James McAvoy that has now, what is it, this is the fifth movie? Was it First Class, Days of Future Past, Apocalypse? I feel like there's one more.
Well, Logan was in the middle of them.
Yeah. No, there's got it. There's definitely one more.
Really? Sounds right to me.
Oh, we're testing.
And the fourth one.
And the fourth one.
Okay. And so this would be the fourth one, and the one to end it, to collapse that, because this is the final X-Men movie, presumably, before Disney completes its acquisition of Fox. This is the first one that Simon Kinberg is directing. He wrote the other ones. And this is, in many ways, a revisiting of that first X-Men trilogy with X-Men The Last Stand also being about Jean Grey becoming Phoenix.
Right.
And that one famously directed by McGee. So the trailer's interesting. They're telegraphing big deaths in the trailer. And the director and writer they've been upfront about the fact that lots of people are going to die in this one because they don't really care.
Big death seems to sell tickets.
Exactly. And also they don't seem to care because this franchise probably will not live on in this form for much longer. So and Jennifer Lawrence is getting too big of a movie star to be in X-Men movies anyway.
Yeah, to be blue.
Yes, yeah. That makeup just takes too long to put on. Speaking of reboots, Hellboy, new trailer for that.
Ooh.
Now, this one, the second trailer shows a lot more action. It's a rated R, restricted red band trailer.
Yeah.
Still not convinced yet?
I am so not convinced.
I love the character. It seems like they are retreading some old ground with his origins, that's the part I think is unnecessary. I think if you're going to tell a Hellboy story, we already had some great Hellboy stories.
Super derivative.
A different Hellboy story.
Yes, or I
love David Harbour, so I will give him the benefit of the doubt. And
the dude from Stranger Things?
The dude from the chief. He plays good. Hellboy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he sounds like Ron Perlman in all of the lines. Like, I'm like, is it that different? Like, in his makeup, isn't...
He's gruff. He's gruff and he's sassy.
Yeah.
These are the defining characteristics of Hellboy. And he fights giant monsters. So that's going to come out soon as well. Couple of home video releases. Alien is going to get a 4K HDR release.
The word home video just sounds like VHS. I'm just saying.
It is home video.
4K actually HDR is the opposite.
Home video is technically still the accurate term.
All right.
It is a home video release.
4K HDR Alien.
Alien.
This is great because I was thinking of watching this again soon.
Oh, you're going to introduce it to your kid?
Yeah. So.
Wow.
Yeah, he's been one. He's ready for it. Like we did Sixth Sense, so I know he can handle the Alien. But now that it's coming out in HD, I'll just wait another month.
Yeah. April 23rd when that's coming out, and I'm sure it's going to be available for digital streaming in many places. I over the past weekend bought and rewatched Into the Spider-Verse.
Oh,
and
nice!
That in 4K HDR,
that's
even
out?
Via iTunes, looks so good.
Yeah, I want to frame by frame that thing.
It's so good, actually. It almost looks too good and too CG in some places.
Oh.
I think when I first watched it, and I watched it in Dolby Vision, or Dolby Cinema, so it was like the best place to watch it. A lot of the rendering in that film was almost like passing off as cell animation and really convincing.
Mm-hmm.
At home, there's some scenes early on in the film that I could tell is just a little bit video gamey. In its CG animation.
You don't have motion smoothing on.
I was going to say, your TV's not...
No, just in the crispness of it. Yeah, but there's some action sequences. You can definitely tell like the places where they devoted a ton of action. The first fight with Dr. Octopus, I'll just say, if you haven't seen the film, was amazing. The first Spider-Man action sequence with Green Goblin is incredible.
The trees, the whole... good stuff.
Yeah. What are the extras on that?
They have a 4-minute Spider-Ham short film that is a prequel to Spider-Ham and shows how he gets into the Spider-Verse.
Wow, okay.
John Mulaney voices that. It's all done with cell animation. It's fantastic. There is a expanded commentary cut of the film, so you watch it with not just director's commentary, but like the special, like they pause it and talk about certain scenes. They call it an alternate universe mode.
Hmm.
And then there's a lot of featurettes.
And you got this from download?
iTunes.
Wow.
And iTunes?
You all that?
Is that a different render? Or is it? Do they like pause the actual film and then play a different video file?
I don't know. I don't know how. Because in the old days, like with DVDs, when Matrix came out and they had those special
things.
Separate
disc.
Had separate disc, or they had it built into the DVD system.
A different
where they
track.
Could move tracks. Yeah. Right? At certain times, you could jump to a commentary behind the scenes track and then jump back into the film.
Yeah.
Hit that white rabbit button. but I don't know if this is done algorithmically or if it's like just re-render.
That's neat.
That's cool.
iTunes is streaming no matter what. You never download anything for iTunes.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There's no storage for aside from apps and games on Apple
TV. Is the compression noticeable at all?
So I was debating whether I was going to get the disc, which includes the iTunes code, but at convenience sake, I just got the iTunes one. And I think animated films always look great no matter what.
Because there's so much field of continuous color.
Exactly, right.
You don't get that noise.
Yeah. And so the bit rates are totally fine, even at 4K HDR. Yeah.
Nice.
Totally recommended, of course, it being not only the best animated film of last year, but one of the best films of last year.
Oscar winning.
Hey, it's the Nintendo Switch's second anniversary. As Sony PlayStation is retiring the Vita, the Switch celebrates its second year of success this past week. You guys both have a Switch, I presume?
I don't have a Switch. I still play an original Wii. Like, in this last week, in our house, we play a Wii. Like, that's...
Then there's no reason not to get the Switch, because you have Wii parody.
Wii parody.
With the Switch.
What
you got Waggle.
About?
You got Waggle in the controls.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I've been playing a little bit of Tetris 99.
I heard that's the hot stuff.
What is that?
Do you not know about?
I know about Tetris Effect.
No.
Wait. What?
the
Okay, so there was a Nintendo Direct, their big press conference,
yeah,
a week and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that was a surprise announcement, because Switch for the first year, multiplayer was free. Right, and now you have to pay for kind of like an Xbox Live subscription, $20 a year,
yeah,
to do any type of multiplayer games. Mm-hmm. One of the ways they're getting people to do multiplayer is they release for free. Still free now. You can do this, Jeremy.
Okay.
Tetris Battle Royale called Tetris 99.
On the Switch?
On the Switch.
Wow. See, I don't even have a Switch and I know about this. It's
wait, let me explain this to you, because it is even better than you can imagine. Tetris 99. Because Sean and I talked about it last week. I'm going to talk about it again. So you have your Tetris board that you play,
yeah,
and you're playing Tetris.
Uh-huh.
Now, have you done like multiplayer Tetris before?
Nope.
Competitive Tetris is multiplayer Tetris.
I've watched it.
You've watched it, right?
Yep.
And one of the ways that multiplayer Tetris works is that as you get Tetrises, as you build it, you actually are sending inconveniences to an opponent. You're adding things.
A Tetris being four lines.
As you get four lines,
okay.
And as you rack up points and do it with like grace and style, you are then making it more difficult or hindering,
yeah,
a direct opponent by like adding like a whole block of random cubes to the bottom of their board, raising their board by four lines, and so they have to keep up as well.
My God!
And so, but how do you do that in a battle royale setting?
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is so cool. You're watching your own Tetris, playing Tetris game. You see all 98 other games being played at the same time in real time in miniature windows all around you.
Which I can only imagine being playable on a big screen. Like, if you can't take that portable.
Well, it's an indication of how many people are still in the game, I guess.
And not only do you see the screens getting grayed out,
yeah,
as people are dying, because in multiplayer Tetris you have to have an opponent, you can use the other stick to direct who is your opponent. Because you can see that person's doing very poorly, and then you can target them.
Oh, that's mean.
And you can see who's targeting you.
Oh.
And yeah. So you can build grudges within this meta level, the game within a game of Tetris.
I'm okay. Just not that good. Like, I'm focused so much on just playing Tetris, I don't have time
to,
like...
Yeah. You could focus on... But there is a whole meta
level.
And
then you would die.
I mean, unless you're really, really good. There's
right.
Videos of people just like... The top four, like three lines of clearing space ahead and above them, and they're like surviving for minutes long.
So how far have you gotten?
I've only gotten like 38. I'm
That's
not very good.
Pretty good though.
I know a bunch of people who've gotten first place.
What?
Wow.
Yeah. Who?
A bunch of people.
Chicken dinners?
Yeah, they've gotten their Tetris chicken dinners. Tetris dinners.
It's not Will Smith, is it?
No, I don't know. Actually, I don't know. He's outside, right outside the door right now. Actually, you can go ask him. He's waiting for episode 500. If you're into Tetris, it's really recommended. And you could actually play as a family, because you could have second player be the person helping you target.
Oh, I thought you meant you could play it in the same round. Like, can you do that somehow? Can you sync up with friends?
I don't know. I haven't tried it. I want to say you probably.
Hmm. So matchmaking, maybe.
Yeah.
And then, but you can do co-op with.
Okay. But basically, you could have a second person help with your targeting, the metagame,
sure,
of how to target,
right,
and giving you commentary of like, you gotta stay alive, there's only three people left, and one person's died, almost dead.
Can you see what piece is up next?
Yes, you can see like the next four or five pieces.
Holy cow.
Six pieces.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And you have the storage area, so you can swap out.
Oh, wow.
But
no,
can you throw like bananas or bombs or
no,
ink?
No.
No, you can't do any of those.
This is serious.
Yeah, no, yeah. It's silly.
Wow. All right. I'll definitely have to get that. It's a no brainer.
Yeah. It's free.
Thank you for the tip.
Tetris 99. Switch. Congratulations on your second anniversary. A lot of good games. And what a hit for Nintendo.
Yeah. It's their tick year.
Yeah. So this is an interesting thing. MIT Technology Review, I was able to get Bill Gates to kind of curate a story for them, a feature story for their publication, identifying 10 breakthrough technologies that he sees will make a big difference in 2019. Want to go through the list?
Is one your Apple Watch? Because you're just checking it out.
No, but one does have to do with wearables.
Okay.
And EEG. But let's just go through the list.
Fine.
And kind of discuss, because I'm interested, Zach, from your engineering standpoint, how reasonable you think some of these technologies are. And from
I'm going in fresh because I haven't heard any of these. So.
Number one,
mm-hmm,
it's something that we've heard a lot of people talk about: robot dexterity. Now, why does robot dexterity suck today? Zach? I feel like you could explain this.
Energy density. It all has to do with the power sources. So
why can't robot fingers articulate or grab?
They can, and there's been lots of graspers that can have pretty much as close to the same dexterity. But to do it practically, you have a lot more, you know, just from a weight perspective, the number of motors that you'd actually have to have, those are all kind of like off to the side in any of these dexterous hands. So if you want to actually make a mobile platform or something like that, it's a big, heavy thing. Plus you have to have batteries. You know, you're trying to compete with the efficiency of biological muscles. But as we get more efficient motors, better magnets, better design, and we get, you know, higher energy density batteries, then some of these technologies can be, you know, more mobile and useful in things other than, say, like a factory, you know, setting. So, yeah, I mean, I could see that. I don't know that really unlocks any. I'd have to.
So you think it's a physical, it's a mechanical problem right now with the servos.
Well, I think it's just some of it's just a design problem. I mean, we haven't, you know, figured out the best way to, you know, to pack all of those, you know, motors and actuators and things, and also sensing and feedback. But there's been some really good dexterous hands and other graspers and things. I'm trying to figure out what does that technology really unlock? Like what capability or what problem is it really solving?
The problem,
folding laundry? I don't know. Like
even for manufacturing, like Adam talks about how he's talked with engineers who've designed robots where like they can't pick up like pick and place robots.
Sure.
Right.
Absolutely.
Can require certain types of like crutches on the things they're picking or limitations on what they're picking to work. If they could pick and place with sensors and where you can just literally throw down a conveyor line.
But that's not how manufacturing actually happens. Mm. I mean, maybe that puts us more toward, you know, fully autonomous manufacturing. But right now, so much manufacturing, I mean, there are purpose-built robots that do certain tasks. You know, I'm picking up pick and place. I'm picking up a part, placing on a circuit board. That is a completely robotic task. The whole ecosystem is designed around making that possible. The shape of the chips and the way that the solder flows and all of those things, it's all because of automation. We want to be able to do that. The things that require dexterity, humans still do. And I think we're, you know, even with the most dexterous fingers, it's sort of like the autonomous driving problem. You don't understand the edge cases or the manipulation required to shove wires in a small hole because that wire is going to be flexible and bend and do weird things. Like,
you wouldn't want to give that to a robot anyway.
Well, I mean, I don't know what the advantage is other than just like I just want to get humans out of the loop. If that is truly the advantage, then right. I could see that being. But that isn't how manufacturing actually happens. There's still a lot of people employed and sort of relied upon to do those tasks.
What about prosthetics?
Sure.
Human augmentation.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think again, then it comes back to power. So, you know, I've worked on exoskeletons and I've worked on other things that kind of are in that realm. And yeah, the thing that makes it sort of the most inconvenient is, yes, I can power this arm or this leg or this whatever for an hour with something of, you know, a reasonable size battery, but really to do it all day, you know, you would have to have multiple batteries or something that's so heavy that it's just not practical. So yeah, I guess it's there, but from an actual, like, you know, is the dexterity portion of it interesting? I'm not sure. I don't know yet what that unlocks. Like, that's the interesting part.
I feel like it's less in. I mean, I feel like people are going to try to apply it toward manufacturing, and capitalists are going to try to, you know, replace the human jobs in any way possible with technology. But I also feel like a lot of applications may be in that, like telerobotics, you know, remote surgery and. Which is
maybe, yeah.
It's very specialized niche cases. But
if you're doing specialized things, you don't need to make tools be human compatible. You can make them robotically compatible. Yeah. So
they would be specific grips and
That's where I'm like, I don't quite see it there.
Right.
All right.
The goal of replicating everything a finger can do, that's we're also confined by the limitations of
our fingers.
Our fingers. Yeah. Exactly. Sometimes a suction or a vacuum will do just fine.
There's a lot of things on this list.
All right. Yeah. Well, we're going to fill a lot of time with this podcast talking about this list.
Four hours later.
This next one is quite a moonshot. New wave nuclear power.
Is this cold fusion?
Or does it just have more techno drums?
Advanced fusion and fission reactors are edging closer to reality.
Yeah. I mean, fission is bad. Like, we know this. It creates all sorts of, you know, ugly waste at the end of the day. You know, fusion is where it's at if we can make it work and make it sustainable. But, you know, the ignition facility and like a number of these projects, they've come close.
The power of 1,000 exploding suns, Jeremy.
I mean, it is the sci-fi dream. It is the way to power just anything.
Yeah.
Portable fusion devices is in all the books.
My arc reactor, I'm just waiting for it. But yeah, so if we have that, then number one, I think, starts applying.
This article says that it is both considered a pipe dream by many and may be here by 2030.
Sure. I mean, I think it's like so many things in electronics, or it's like, it's a problem, and then you solve it, and then it's like, oh, of course. You know, like, it's somebody forgot to plug in something, or some, you know, there's some that one thing that they didn't try, that mm-hmm. one combination, and then it's like, oh, well, then this makes sense. So yeah, I mean, I think it's just a matter of getting the right discovery and figuring out the hurdles that are required to make it happen, and figuring out if Jeremy can shut off his
Hey, don't worry. That those sounds are on a separate audio track. People might not even be hearing
what? We're just hearing
it? Oh, that's good.
Exactly. Okay. Right. So don't react, Jeremy. Yeah. Don't react. Okay.
So yeah, I mean, I think yes. If we solve the unlimited energy problem, of course, the world is
I feel like
changed forever.
That this is a filler item on this list, because if the guidelines were to come up with 10 breakthrough technologies for 2019, this is like,
it's
oh yeah,
not going to happen.
Not
in 2019.
It's probably stuff that was interesting or this level of interest 3 years ago, and we'll still be in that same phase 3 years from now,
unless somebody has the aha. I think
and nothing in this article indicates that the aha
is close.
Has been made or is close.
Yeah.
We're in 2019. We got a bunch of health stuff in here. We got predicting premature births, which.
Well, I think any of the data analysis stuff. I mean, I think that's actually where what's, you know, we are making such huge strides on with sort of, you know, big neural nets and big data processing and predictive. You know, we're really fine tuning sort of those processes so that we can throw huge amounts of computing at these data sets and make some real discoveries. And I think that's actually, you know, sort of data handling and understanding big data. I think that's actually the most interesting part of kind of what's going on these days.
Mm. And doing it cheap.
And having
a test that's cheap and scalable.
Absolutely.
And that seems like a very Bill Gates thing.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
Solving health problems with solutions that don't cost a lot and that can have a big impact.
Right.
All right, some little more bioengineering. You got gut probes in a pill, swallowable device that can detail your gut, even in infants and children.
Yeah, I mean, they've had swallowable pills with cameras and sensing and stuff like that for a while. I'm not sure why this would make a list of kind of new breakthroughs. Yeah, I mean,
they say that there's a engineer and a pathologist at the Massachusetts General Hospital developing these small gut pills that can even obtain tissue samples and also have miniature microscopes.
Yeah, I mean, there's endoscopes and things. Again, I don't see anything super breakthrough here. I mean, yes, this is interesting stuff, but I think it's more building on previous technology and kind of incremental than like a major.
It could be it's more widespread use,
right?
If it's built, if it's at a point where
maybe cost effective, that's probably the biggest one.
Yeah, your prostate cancer test is now going to this be a standard default thing and be more accurate and less invasive.
I guess as a geek and a nerd. The thing that's interesting to me is not that it's now cheap. It's that initial discovery. So,
right.
You know.
The breakthrough in a different sense.
Right,
You're looking for things you've never seen before.
Exactly.
Yeah. Custom cancer vaccines. This is a little more intangible, but hopefully that will also be the case. They say that these vaccines started coming into development after the Human Genome Project. And, mm-hmm. You know, it is something, again, that's been in development for the past couple of years. And
absolutely.
From his perspective, will be meaningful this year and going forward.
I have, you know, personal experience in this realm. And by all means, you know, customized vaccines, I'm hoping and waiting.
The cow-free burger.
Heck yeah.
Yes.
All right. Carl's Jr. is selling one. You've seen these ads?
No.
No, I haven't seen that.
They're ads for...
Wait, you watch ads?
I watch live events. You can't get away from ads. Nope. You know they're so tangentially. They're so clever now. I was watching a sporting event, and now they have ads that play... Basically, they picture-in-picture your live event and just say, we're not even going to cut away to an ad, so you can fast forward. During some downtime where normally they would cut away, they're going to show you the content of the live sporting event.
They're projecting the burger on the football.
And they will literally take the screen. You're watching a basketball game, a football game, and they will shrink it and play an ad.
They pan and scan.
They pan and scan the ad and then grow out, zoom out.
Yeah.
Because this behind-the-scenes extra content is brought to you by this ad.
Yeah.
It's still live, though.
It's still live because that's how they know that people will watch.
That's
like
wild.
Callous Burgers.
Hey, good idea.
I've had some really good, you know, meatless meat. And I mean,
Impossible Burger.
Impossible Burger's good. And there's a bunch of them. And even the ones that aren't like trying to be hamburger, like that are just like good burgers, but they're, you know, made with mushrooms and you know, other grains and whatnot. Like, I've been like, oh, this is actually a really enjoyable thing.
I think that they're a fantastic option for people who are vegan or vegetarian. But I don't think that's the reason why it's on this list. I think it's on this list because there's just not enough food in the world. And people can fabricate a delicious burger.
Well, from an energy perspective, you know, where they say like 10 pounds of grain makes 1 pound of burger or something like that. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, the further we get to making, you know, meatless options, you know, from a world perspective and energy perspective, it's so much better.
And the two companies, the Beyond Meat and Impossible Foods, are the two big companies working in this. Of course, working from the other way, getting a lot of attention, making gourmet burgers now in places like Carl's Jr. Eventually, make its way into your supermarket.
Right.
But all of that, we're finding a process that then can be really deployed.
Yeah.
Globally, and not just for. Vegans.
They've taken the Tesla, you know, Roadster approach of I'm going to sell a, you know, $16 burger, and now it's come down to the $35,000 car or the whatever it is at Carl's Jr. It's the
same
thing.
Which means we're a lot farther away than your $10,000 your very baseline consumable.
Right. Are we going to have an autonomous hamburger anytime soon? I don't know.
Bill Gates is an investor in both Beyond and Impossible.
Ooh, interesting.
Oh, makes sense. Beyond Meat, they say, has a now 26,000 square foot plant in California making, upwards of 25 million burgers.
Making burger.
Make it. That's a lot. That's a lot of fake meat. A carbon dioxide catcher. Of course, there's a, you know, a green gas element to this.
Yeah.
Global warming. It seems like there are some advances into just engineering solutions to capture CO2?
I think this is one of those sort of like a magic diet pill where it sounds great, like, oh, we can just keep driving and we can keep eating our hamburgers and we can keep doing all of these things if we just have these machines to then counteract all of that. But I think that's still kind of, I mean, while it's great, I don't see it scaling to really make any dent in, you know, greenhouse gases.
Systemic, I mean, that's the whole point of the New Green Deal, right? Systemic changes are needed. It's not any one,
right?
It's not flying less or not using an SUV. People are going to do those anyway,
right?
It's like there are big,
huge changes. I mean, and I would love a magic pill.
And economic incentives. Right. I think the big thing is economic incentives,
right? Because that's really the only thing that's going to move a populace, not just, you know, say, hey, drive less,
follow the money.
Yeah.
Here goes your watch, your ECG on your wrist.
Yep.
Yeah.
Your fitness tracker that will also. Mm-hmm. Measure
big data
a lot more.
It's just big data. I mean, collect more data, give me more info. You know, it's all a numbers game. I mean, that's what medicine is these days. It's, you know, whether it's cancer treatment or, you know, heart health or any of those things, it's all just capturing data and studies and basically applying those studies. So the more studies we can do, and if we're all part of a, you know, data set, then that information just gets better.
And then last two one, sanitation without sewers, something people don't think about. If you don't have pipes, you don't have infrastructure, how do you have a new type of toilet that's cheap enough but also can be clean enough for people to use globally? That seems, again, very much like one of those XPRIZE.
Dean Kamen was making a water purifier.
Yeah, so in that very same vein, right?
This is, well, I think, people are focused on a lot on the input, not the output.
There you go.
So, yeah.
Spoken like an engineer. Well done. And then last one, a lot more this consumer facing, smooth talking AI assistants.
Smooth talking.
Smarter, yeah. More Give conversational.
Me Give me that.
Yeah.
We'll be replaced soon. Just be, you know, three Google assistants up here.
I really like that of all these things on this list, only two of them really are consumer electronics based, right? Your AI assistants and your smartwatches. And I'm glad that the breakthrough technologies that have been identified by someone like Bill Gates, who takes a big view, and someone who has worked just in consumer electronics and consumer software space, the things that he thinks will matter are big picture items.
Well, I mean, I think part of it is the last however many years he's been out of tech and been more into global health and, you know, malaria and sort of more global issues. So that has definitely broadened his spectrum of interest.
Yeah, I'm curious why there was nothing about transport here. I mean, I'm not even talking about autonomous cars, but just the solving
the systemic problem of the
mass
high
transit.
Energy cost of mass transit. So
exactly.
Trains and planes and, you know, all those areas which are ripe for advancement.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm so glad we didn't see foldable phones on this list. That was not going to be a breakthrough technology of 2019. Bendable OLEDs. And also not going to be a breakthrough technology of 2019, because I don't think it's going to come out in 2019. USB 4.
Oh, Jesus.
USB 4.
Now, you missed our USB 3.2 discussion last week, Jeremy. I don't think I want to recap it, because
it's not a happy discussion.
Hurts.
All of USB, I mean, USB's lovely. From a consumer perspective, it's wonderful. From a developer perspective, it's an absolute nightmare. And, you know, trying to actually produce a product that meets a spec. I mean, and part of it is half the companies just say, I'm not going to meet the spec. I don't even care. You know, it used to be that you had to have a little sticker on your product that said, you know, USB approved or whatever it was. And nowadays, you know, people plug anything in their USB, they don't even think about it. So from a consumer side, it's just like, oh, more, better, faster. But from a, you know, from an engineering side, it's okay, how much current can I draw? How much voltage is going to be there? What voltage rails do I have to work with? You know, I love the fact that I have more bandwidth and more voltage and more current. Like, that's fine. But the problem is, if they're using the same plug and they're plugging, you know, I can't then design a product that always expects, you know, a higher voltage rail or more than, say, 2 amps of power. And because the consumer doesn't know any better, they're just going to assume it works. And then when
I mean,
it fails,
that's the catch-22 of USB,
right?
Like they've built this legacy of the port that just works, and now it's incredibly convoluted and complex.
Yeah.
Not just the naming schemes, but just the standards within the standard.
And there's no standard. I mean, that's the thing. It's not a standard anymore. It's just, oh, yeah, there's a square in my computer that I can stick something in, and maybe it'll work.
And presumably USB-C as a port was supposed to change all that, but then they're having no standards there.
I have USB-C cables with a USB-A on the other end. Like, that's it's
you're never going to get away with that USB-A port.
Yeah.
Well, USB 4, which is going to move past USB 3.2 Gen 3... I'm sorry, Gen 2
X2. X2, right.
Gen 2 X2 will have a baseline of 40 gigabits per second bandwidth, plus also incorporate Intel's Thunderbolt 3 standard, which they're going to finally open up. So Thunderbolt 3.
So shove Thunderbolt onto a USB cable.
Yes.
And okay.
What will the port look like?
To be determined.
Don't know.
Yeah, probably USB-C.
Okay. There you go. We don't know about power yet.
No. Now, what is the max USB-C? How much current can you get through there?
Ooh, well, it has different voltages.
Yeah, it has different rails. I forget what they are. I haven't done a ton with USB-C. But yeah, it depends on which rail you're talking about. And again, there's sort of what you can reliably get and then what the standard is. And, you know, if your port actually meets the standard.
Mm-hmm. Also not on the list, on Bill Gates' list, that is, of the top breakthrough technologies of 2019, but something that's available now, augmented reality, something that we're very into. And, of course, there's Magic Leap, and there's, you know, HoloLens 2 was a big announcement last week.
Yeah.
Remember Magic Leap, when we used it?
Yeah.
There was a demo app for an MBA program.
Uh-huh.
And it was their experimental implementation of what it would be like to have a not a second screen, but a second reality layer to watching your NBA game.
I put the court on my dining room table, as I recall.
That's what it was. So you would theoretically be watching your flat screen NBA game or sports game, whatever it is, on your big TV, because that's not going away. And the whole point of augmented reality is it's not taking away from that.
Why not?
It could even be
it might go away.
It might go away because a rectangular projection,
right?
Whether it's in your headset or in the real world, you would have that's how the game is going to be portrayed as the primary way to enjoy that content. But additionally, to have a second representation of that be a virtual miniature of that with some augmented data, some like using Intel RealSense cameras or however whatever mapping or whatever pre-programmed tracking they have of these players, to then have analytics and insight and commentary on your tabletop. Now, the demo was very limited. It was like one scene that you played out. It's maybe like 20-second video clip plus a replay, essentially. Sure. And the data wasn't that interesting. It was visually novel, for sure. But it didn't really even – wasn't enough to give me a sense of the user experience of what it would be like to watch a full two-hour game while glancing up and down during timeouts to catch replays. Well, we're getting closer to that because Second Spectrum is a company that has tried a new type of visualization just on the TV, but basically augmented reality overlays. And they're using this with analyzing your 16x9 rectangle, your camera capture.
What?
They've demoed this already. There's a Bucks versus Lakers game in which they, in real time, were able to track players and overlay, as you watch the game on your TV, statistics, and even recognize types of plays that were going on. Like in basketball, there's a pick and roll. One player blocks another player, and then the ball gets passed over them.
Okay.
They can recognize that play happening and then draw your on-screen overlay. So whereas a commentator would be doing it in a replay and using their on-screen Sharpie, the computer is doing that.
So like if I had this on my phone and I was watching it with you guys and you guys didn't know I had my phone, I could sound like a sports expert.
And you could be the commentator. You could watch on your phone and then go up to the big screen. See what that guy did right there? He has a 40% accuracy at this spot. Well, he just blocked this player and they enacted the pick and pop. And
I mean,
that's what that play was.
That's the promise of the future. That's why people want the AR glasses, so they can just have this all the time.
The knowledge.
This seems much more practical than the AR glasses because I'm already watching it in the single screen medium.
But is this, I mean, does it unlock anything that a commentator doesn't already give you? I mean, I know from a visual perspective, it's a lot like the overlays on, you know, football that shows, okay, here's the first down line and sort of it's giving you that information in a more manageable way. So it's sort of like, because
it has
an overlay,
all data. The commentator's job is to curate and contextualize.
Right.
And so this, I'm sure over time the feedback loop would give the systems either you the choice to see the data you care about because of a certain stat you care about.
So like what level of how geeky, you know, sports geek do you want? You can turn it up to like ultra where it's like every single shot tells me what percentage it is.
Exactly.
Or just like turn it way down of like,
I just want to see like a certain score thing. Or for gamblers, right? In Vegas, you're talking about real-time data because they analyze and break the stuff and have all their betting down to the minutia. But I bet that even algorithmically, they could optimize this to do what the commentators did, to pop up and feed the overlays in because they know at a certain point of the game that's the information people want.
But then you need to have you either need to have multiple tracks or you need to have some system in the loop. So if this is coming across broadcast television, it doesn't help you. But if it was an app based kind of thing that was actually overlaid, then it would. So there has to be some tie-in, which do we have the infrastructure to even do that?
And then the usability, the viewability question is this something that viewers can acclimate to? You know, just talking about the highlighted, augmented, the first down line, that is something that viewers are now expect, right? It is an augmented piece of augmented reality technology that is ingrained in the way people watch football.
Well, but that's also something that would be there in real life if it was possible.
They have the markers.
The markers.
And, I mean, there's
exactly
there are those things. So I guess the question is, do people want this data? Like, does that add to the experience, or is it an attraction for the general population?
And on the flip side, you have the example of the NHL puck that was glowy and highlighted, and that became something that people did not want, even though ostensibly on the paper it enhanced the viewing experience and gave you better clarity as to the action. No, they removed it very quickly after doing it because that glowing puck was just distracting.
I like the idea of it being an option. If it's a thing you can toggle, fantastic. It looks like a video game mode.
Right, and does it matter if it happens in real time versus in replay mode?
Yeah, like, I want it in real time.
You want it in real time? I don't I don't know. Is that distracting? Like sometimes I just want to see the action for what it is.
I feel you, man. Just turn it off.
Yeah.
Again, we all want
I want that option.
Yeah.
Yeah. But very cool. And I do think, going back to augmented reality, this makes more practical sense, especially if you're just baking it into the broadcast.
Sure.
And two, as a way to refine those technologies so that it's all going to be there. The layers of data are going to be there to map over whatever.
I mean, and I think we're just going to get used to day-to-day life having access to more data if we want it. And I think that's going to be, you know, how do we get that data, whether it's glasses or whether it's on regular media or whatever it is. I mean, we're already getting there. Like, we're getting to this point where we have access to this data, whether it's just over the internet or second screen watching when you're watching your Walking Dead or whatever it is. Like, all of that is just becoming more and more kind of part of daily life. So,
all right, we're going to wrap up tech news with a bunch of Amazon news. Amazon last week announced what they're calling Project Zero, and they're working with some brands that will solve a big problem that people have with Amazon shopping, and that's counterfeit listings of products. I'm sure both of you had plenty of times where you've bought things that look like they're the thing you're looking for, but they're just mislabeled, or in some cases, flat out lies.
Or just never arrive, or yeah.
And so they know this is a problem. This hurts the reputation of them as a storefront, of their partners who are using Amazon as a storefront, and they have the data with the reviews, so they're going to allow those manufacturers to flag objects and then even remove the listings on their own.
It's an interesting one because if they're relying on reviews, the problem is there's also fake reviews.
Yeah, and I don't think they're sold. I think reviews are just one data point for them to flag.
Sure.
Like if you're selling,
if there's enough calls to their feedback line, enough returns, yeah, that makes sense. I mean, then it's.
It's just a little dangerous, for if they're going to give them the keys to the castle like that. I mean, they could easily lead to
abuse,
companies shutting down competition. That's legit.
Yeah, small players.
Right. And so it's chosen companies. I'm sure it's big companies where the counterfeit, maybe there's a rights issue, whether there's patents involved or branding. Someone's using your branding.
How many fake earbuds or, there's so many. Kind of things. But then the question is, do you want to trust Amazon to police that?
Right. And then also the companies there's going to be basically a little wiggle room for tolerance. If they start flagging things and taking down competitors, they will lose these privileges quickly. Amazon's also offering services to serialize products. Mm. So the stock they have. So when you get it, you get a way to actually say you are getting a verified product as verified by Amazon in partnership with this manufacturer. Very interesting. Amazon's also discontinuing Dash buttons. Was this ever a good idea?
This is a weird thing, man. This is like item specific buttons.
Yeah.
It was the big buy it now button.
It makes no sense to me.
Well, it was before, all the assistants. I won't say the name, but it started that process of like I'm going to have a piece of technology in my house that makes the buying process a little bit easier.
And whether it was for detergent that you would put this button right by your laundry machine, it would be easier than
saying
opening
up
an app. Exactly.
Or
dude, it clearly was a bad idea. No, nobody bought them.
No. You didn't have to buy them.
It's a boardroom idea, right? Like you can see somebody saying, "What if we had a button?"
That's it.
And all you had to do was press it when you run out of detergent, and you get sent more detergent.
From an engineering perspective, I was super fascinated with them. Like the fact that they could make them as cheap as they did, and the fact that they joined your network as the way that they did, and like from a product, it was like, "Oh, this is really clever." But from an overall experience and like a need?
I think there was missed opportunities because they had to be that cheap by necessity and there was no feedback whatsoever. Even your smart assistant devices have feedback to one confirm the orders and let you track them. But also the opportunity for this is a way for them to get a product into your house, a branded Tide, Puck product, whatever, your Gain detergent. but a way for them to entice you to buy more.
Sure.
Right? Like,
because I have a thing that I can just push and it's right there.
And there are opportunities for them to somehow flag like the way these smart instances work, especially ones with screens. Open them and you can have $5 off if you buy this thing now.
So here's a question. When was the last time you purchased something through your assistant?
Like weekly.
Really?
Yep.
We have one. I don't think we've ever actually used it for purchases.
It's for this kind of thing. When we're in the laundry room or the kitchen and we run out of garbage bags, we say, device, order more garbage bags.
So you don't care that the price may have changed or that you don't try to shop every time.
For garbage bags?
Sometimes I like to know when I'm out of garbage bags. What the last time I bought them was.
This is an insight into Norm's and purchasing.
Whether, wow, they've increased the price by $10. Maybe I should shop for a different brand
of
garbage bags.
You have a child now. You can't pay attention to that.
I was about to say, I have used this
for
voice
diapers.
For diapers and formula are the two things.
But do you shop around? Are you like, well,
no,
these diapers
because
are...
Because I need those now.
You can't use your brain on that
I need
kind
those,
of decision power.
And I am going to trust that they're not going to gouge me.
Yeah,
And that's going to arrive in 2 days.
And it's a brand, it's a one that you like because you ordered it before.
Right.
So there it comes.
Sometimes supply changes. Sometimes there might be a better one. For a garbage bag, I'm going to buy them once every couple months. There might be a new color.
This last Amazon bit of news better be that they are improving their courier service.
Oh.
It is not. It is not.
Then I don't care.
This is number 8 on Jeremy's list of frustrations.
So... Amazon is concerned with their carbon footprint and you know, the cost
no,
of convenience.
Not. No, they're not.
They say they
They
are.
Say they are.
They say they are. Or they know, they acknowledge that certain customers are concerned about the carbon footprint of Amazon.
Oh, my gosh.
They have a PR person telling them to be concerned about their,
This is a way for them to save money.
Maybe. So what they're doing is that for select customers, they can opt into a program where... Their prime delivery window is going to, as opposed to being guaranteed 2 days, you'll be guaranteed a delivery day per household once a week.
They've offered me this for a long time now.
Have they?
And I've never opted into it.
Because you want the flexibility.
I'm paying for Prime, and I want it to come in 2 days. Especially, like, I'm working on projects. It's one of the things I count on now.
Yeah,
is to get these things stat.
Well, they say that this program has already reduced packaging by tens of thousands of boxes, which sounds like a small blip.
If they wanted to reduce
like
packaging.
That's five shipments, right? Tens of thousands of boxes.
Yeah.
Yeah, they would not put a box in a box in a box in a box.
Exactly.
Now, what I do like that solves both problems is they have these delivery centers. We've talked about that before, how they have one in Berkeley.
Yeah.
And it's fantastic because it gets there like before 8 a.m.
Same day.
Same day sometimes.
Yeah.
And so that saves them gas. It saves me time. And if they had one of those in San Francisco, which apparently isn't out of the question, then that would be fantastic.
Well, especially since they have a Prime same-day shipping distribution center in San Francisco.
I will use my EV. I won't burn any carbon. I will drive to the distribution center. I will pick it up.
Now, you know, they also have that option, even though you pay for Prime shipping, they have the option to incentivize you to choose slower shipping.
I've never been incentivized.
I have done that every time.
What?
What?
Not every every time that's reasonable. Anytime I don't need it for 2 days, I do it because I will accumulate those accumulate the Amazon.
We're learning so much today.
I had no idea.
Sometimes I don't need something in 2 days. I can take something next week.
I do
it's
do
about
that
planning.
When I travel and no one's going to be home,
it's an advantage for you.
I mean, I'll do
it. Yeah, right.
Sometimes
I don't want it sitting on my doorstep.
No rush shipping is totally fine for a lot of things. You just got to plan. Don't buy your detergent when you're out of detergent.
One thing I have considered is, does the no rush shipping always give you USPS or a good courier? Because if I could avoid getting Amazon's couriers, I might do that. I've always said I would pay a fee not to use their courier.
But would you wait an extra week?
Maybe. For the right thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the incentives... work, and I think their studies have shown that those incentives do work. That they're, you know, they're dollar
your
digital
studies.
My anecdotal study has said
it's in
works.
This little 2016 paper using data from Amazon Prime showed that customers are likely to select slower shipping if Amazon offered to buy carbon offsets in lieu of 2 day shipping. So if there is some type of extra benefit, people will will choose that.
It's because you get the dollar.
I also like having that dollar, to pocket that dollar. Mm. You pocket enough of those, I can rent a movie.
That's college tuition.
$1 at a time.
Yeah, can I get matching on that? That a contribution. That does it for technology news. Before we move on to our next segment, I want to thank the sponsor that makes this episode possible, and that's MailChimp. MailChimp is an easy-to-use marketing platform with a name that might make it sound like they only do email. But they do just about everything to help businesses grow. With email, ads, postcards, landing pages, audience management tools, automations, reports, and more, you know you'll be doing marketing right, because growth looks different to everyone. So MailChimp helps guide you make the right marketing decisions for your business. You can create a customer list, connect an online store, test an email variation, or analyze a marketing report. MailChimp understands that business owners would rather focus on their passion than rather focus on marketing. So they automated the marketing process. And they started just by doing email marketing, but then now they do so much more. You could say they outgrew their name, and now their marketing tools can help you do the same. Go to MailChimp.com to sign up for free and see how MailChimp can help grow your business. MailChimp, they do more than email.
I'm a pinball nerd. Just to my point, finally. Pinball. That makes me very happy.
I hesitate to share this news with people because it's early. But
a spoiler.
If you have a VR headset and you like pinball, pay attention. Because Visual Pinball, aka Pin Mame, has been ported to virtual reality.
Whoa.
So you can play any of the, I want to say hundreds of games that have been remade in Visual Pinball.
These are user contributions.
These are fan-made, user-made tables that, you know, all of the artwork obviously is photographed, all the geometry is modeled, and they put them all together. This program has been around for over a decade.
Sure.
It's open source, and so somebody took the source, and they took the latest beta version of Visual Pinball, and they made it in a GL. They used OpenGL, and they made it work on Steam VR. So it works on the Rift, the Vive, Windows Mixed Reality.
Does it work on your pinball hardware?
And it does, of course, work with my pinball hardware, because that just looks like a gamepad. So people, honestly, there's like 47 people who have downloaded this. So it's really early. It's a small crowd. But if you've got the VR and you've got a knack for pinball, this is, it's typical PC gaming. Like, it's a pain in the butt to set up. You got to install the right things. You got to put things in the right folders. But once you get it working, it's free and it's awesome.
That's great.
Because you can now play 100 games that you couldn't. No one's played the classics yet in VR. And for me, this is a real taste of the future. I mean, like, we've talked about how in the VR future, augmented reality future, you'll have arcade games. But it's always been difficult to imagine what it'd be like to have a pinball machine.
Right. Now, how do you feel about, I mean, I wouldn't call this pirating, but it is taking somebody else's work and bringing it in and, giving it to people, to the masses. Does that feel...
It's just like MAME. It's just like MAME.
Yeah.
And, people play Asteroids and Gauntlet and Joust all the time.
Absolutely.
And even Stern Pinball has said, they're the main manufacturer still in the game. They have said numerous times, go ahead, emulate the old games all you want. We're not going to remake those.
Okay.
But just stay away from the new stuff. And so, by and large, they do. People are working on remaking the new games, but I don't even know how to get them working. It's much more complicated.
Right. Well,
but the classics, you're talking about the Williams games from the 90s, it's like it's all there, and they look good. Like, and whereas they don't look as good as like one of the as they would if one of the majors remade them, like Pinball FX, Zen Pinball. They're remaking a lot of the classics right now in 2D. And a lot of people are trying to get them to make VR versions, but they're just in 2D so far. And they don't look as good as that. So if they ever were to go VR, that would be the amazing... That would be
geometry, real model.
Where to go. Yeah. Like, beautiful renders.
But the fans are doing it.
But the fan, yeah. So these are all fan-made. The physics are good. So it's like more about like the behavior of the ball. It's all solid. And it's just really good. So just Google it. Visual Pinball MAME. Check Reddit. There's a list of the things you need to do to get working. Highly recommended. It's a taste of the future.
That's great.
I'm excited for it. What are we doing next?
VR Minute. Let's do it.
The VR Minute. Virtual reality this week.
Couple of things in anticipation of GDC, which is in just like three weeks from now, maybe less than by the time you're listening to this,
right?
The week of the 18th.
Yeah.
Yeah. We anticipate a lot of VR games be demoed there, but before GDC, we will also see the release of the first Beat Saber music pack.
Yeah, it's coming up on the 14th, right?
Yes. Yes, 314. Now, Beat Saber, possibly the biggest success in VR last year.
I thought Job Simulator was the biggest success.
This past year.
Beat Saber is big, man. It went, found a home in the arcades.
Yeah, yeah. They've built out location-based Beat Saber experiences. It's on all the platforms. People have made their own tracks. And now, you know, if you like the style of the music, the first track, first release, you may like their upcoming DLC release.
Though they keep breaking, if you've loaded any of the custom tracks, every upgrade, you have to go back through and fix the any custom tracks you put in there.
Oh, I haven't done custom tracks.
Oh, yeah.
Have you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's hot in our house.
Do they play well?
You know, like any fan-made content, you know, there's good and bad, but yeah, there's some really good ones in there, and definitely adds to the experience. I'm sure from a licensing standpoint, you know, a lot of people are using, you know, real songs in their custom made packs. So, you know, they kind of have to break them probably from a legal standpoint, but it definitely adds to the game, and it's, yeah.
I'll be curious how their DLC works, because as far as I know, Oculus does not support DLC in their store. And so people who have incorporated it have had to do it themselves.
It's not a smooth, there's not just a add-on to this particular piece of software. So maybe it
you'd
will
have
be...
to revamp the game or a separate SKU.
Or it's internal, or it's actually inside the game.
That's what I mean. Like, it's their own storefront that's inside their own game. But they're on Steam, right? I mean, they're on other platforms.
Steam is much more...
Yeah, Steam's definitely got that all figured out. Hmm. Have you guys played Oculus Go this weekend? You don't have an Oculus
Go. I don't have a Go.
Not this past week.
They released a couple updates that broke a lot of people's stuff.
Oh.
24 hours ago. If your system update coincided with the new UI update, people are having major problems.
As in Windows system?
No, as in like the firmware.
Oh, firmware.
They released a visual update along with a firmware update. And apparently the visual update has caused some people to have like 15-second wait times between hitting a button and anything happening. Lots of rebooting, instability, you know, the thing doesn't work, lots of contacting support, support's being quiet. It's a short, you know, turnaround in terms of like having a problem and expecting a solution, but...
And this seems to be 1 year almost to the day after the great outage of 2018.
Oh,
Rift outage.
On Rift, you
mean.
Yeah. Where people got a poster.
And got the $15
credit. Yeah. That's actually, I bought Beat Saber with that credit. I did. I pre-ordered it.
That credit actually goes away, I think, after a year, so people should spend it.
Oh, I didn't. No, it doesn't go away.
It does go away. People have been posting saying that.
It went away?
Don't forget about the credit in the fine print.
You know what I'm going to buy? I'm going to buy... arcade games and that arcade thing on Go.
Oh, nice. Yeah. You know,
yeah, I'm going to buy Joust.
Boneworks. These are the Stress Level Zero people who made Hover Junkers, and they have been teasing this. We played an early version of it last year at GDC, but they're kind of experimental physics engine for VR based on lessons they had from both Hover Junkers and also their Duck Hunt, Duck Season game, and it looks like a sandbox, almost like Gary's Mod style sandbox, where you can, you know, experiment with their weapons, their combat, their IK, but there apparently will be a story.
I think that's
a portal like story.
That's the tech demo side of things they're showing people. They're claiming, I mean, the promise is big. They're claiming that they are combining all the lessons everyone's learned from VR, right? Like climby.
Mm-hmm.
You know, shooting mechanics.
Yep.
Everything in the game is a physics object.
Yeah.
And everything can be used and grabbed, and you can like grab a bar and pull yourself along it, or you can grab a sword from different positions. You can throw things. The throwing accuracy is natural.
And they know what people are responding to and have responded to. Things like that physicality of climbing, and also the physics-based weapons of that medieval...
Gorn?
No, there's Gorn, but there's also this other one. I think people have their VR legs and want these things now, and you still are kind of limited by some of the touch controls.
My continual concern, and I may be in the minority, is still motion sickness. Like even some of the most motion sick friendly games still get me.
Really?
Yeah. No, there's just something about not having it be perfect. I'm just super sensitive to it. So,
Have you ever tried Jet Island?
No.
I love that game.
It sounds like I would throw up in like two seconds.
I think you would. But it's so intense. Yeah. It is just lovely.
My daughter likes to load those games up and say, "Hey, Dad, try this." And, you know, it's like some roller coaster thing. And I'm just like,
that's mean.
It really is. She has a mean streak, but she gets it from me. So it comes natural.
Just sit down in this chair.
Yeah,
and
right.
Load this up and then spin you real quickly. When I was gone 2 weeks ago, did you guys talk about that leaked letter on that? In the book that was coming out?
We did.
Have you guys read the book?
I'm into chapter one.
How is it so far?
Having
lived through it.
It's good. I think I'm going to come away with it liking Palmer more, you know, which I didn't expect because of the way that he exited and that whole thing with Nimble America. But I'm learning more about his roots at this point. I'm already like, I really want to hang out with this guy. He's into some cool stuff. He's like got some similar interests.
Just a few not so similar interests. But other than that.
Exactly. I don't know. It's just, I from what I understand, the book is largely about his time there and in his arc. Mm-hmm. And it concludes when he leaves. So I'll be curious to see how I feel at the end of it. But I'm enjoying it. I've got a lot of pages left.
I have the audiobook. I'm going to go listen to it on my
How do you like the reader?
No, I haven't listened to it.
Okay, you haven't started yet.
I just own the audiobook.
Yeah.
It will be for my next trip.
Did you use your Amazon Bucks for that?
I did.
Yeah.
I did. Yeah. I think that does it for then the VR Minute and for the podcast this week. Any fun things you guys have been testing, building?
I'm making a cool thing, yeah. I mean, it's not like a tested thing, but we were at Pinball League, right? A couple weeks ago, as one is on Wednesday night. And a friend of mine who I operate a Ghostbusters with said, what can we do to make Ghostbusters cool?
And not that it's not cool already.
It's super cool. It's like, it's well earned to back its money. We're just like, what could we do to make it cooler? And I said, why don't we put a TV on the top that's always playing Ghostbusters? What? And I just wanted to put a TV up there, but he was like, no, it has to be 80s. It has to look from the decade. So I took a $70 LCD HDMI monitor from Amazon, and I laser cut and 3D print all the materials to make it look like an old 1980s TV.
The
bezel. It's got a dials.
Does it have rabbit ears?
Speaker grill. Rabbit ears.
Yes.
How did you make this screen? Did you have a curve?
I didn't do a curve. I looked into doing like a lenticular thing, so it would look like it had curve, but I decided not to. This is how it looks.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, rabbit ears and the whole
bit. Wow, for everybody at home, this looks really good.
How big is that?
The whole screen is a 9-inch screen.
Okay,
so this is a
small miniature
TV. 4 or 5.
Got it.
Yeah. Like, that's a Raspberry Pi Zero on the back.
Oh, nice, nice.
Yeah.
And so it'll play real Ghostbusters?
That's all it will ever do. It will play Ghostbusters, and then it will play Ghostbusters again. 1 and 2.
Oh, the movies, not the cartoon. Got it.
I could do the cartoon.
Real Ghostbusters.
But the game is only about the two movies.
That's true. But the art is cartoonish.
So it's going to be a topper. It's going to run off pinball power, put it up there, turn on the game. It will turn on the movies.
Wow, I like that your really enhancements good. Not only are fun projects, but they become a track mode toys to get people to play your game that you are operating.
Got
to
make that money.
You're marketing.
Yeah.
Engineering some marketing.
That's so good.
And where else can you play a Ghostbusters pinball machine with playing Ghostbusters?
Nowhere else.
Nowhere.
Only at Free Gold Watch in San Francisco.
There you go. Zach, any fun projects, things?
We already talked about my plasma cutter. That's my big build for personal stuff, and yeah, I'm excited about that. And
you brought in a soldering kit that
I carry it with me wherever I go.
Yes.
I think Jeremy did a review on the site of the little TS-80 soldering iron. And I do enough soldering where I carry a little battery pack and kind of my whole little setup just around with me. And yeah, you never know when somebody needs a little extra solder. I mean, I think our headphones could probably use a little.
Bet they could. Yeah, get rid of that 60 hertz.
That 60 hertz, exactly. Yes, make my other ear work. So.
I love that you have everything in an Altoids 10.
Oh. Yeah, well, otherwise you get those little bits of solder, you know, and you don't want that mixed up with, you know, your personal goods. So keeps it all nice and clean.
Very cool. Awesome. Well, that does it for this week's episode. We'll be back next week with yet another episode. If there's breaking news that happened the past 2 days, world-changing news.
Oh, this is still coming out on Thursday?
Yeah, it's coming out on Thursday. We apologize, and we'll talk about it next week. We got an outro this week?
From Imperialist Rex.
Hi there. I didn't see you. Tested.
I need to relax now. Shoelaces untightened just a little bit.
What? Oh my god, that's amazing. What is that happening?
What the heck is going on?
Oh, wow.
Dude, that a lot of blood.
Kishore. Ah, this is unfortunate. This is not good science. Make it so, Lego.
Nice.
That's editing.
Well done.